Unscripted.
Each episode is available to view on YouTube, so be sure to check us out.
You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Our minds actually are employed by us most often to provide rational arguments for things we already believe. So we have an intuitive response to the world or to an action. Or, you know, you walk outside and you see somebody abusing a child, right? We don't go through a logical calculation to decide if that's right or wrong, bad or good. We intuitively know, but then we'll formulate an argument to give expression to our rational foundation for a moral position. And so that's what Chesterton means when he says, if you strip our minds down to nothing but pure logic or pure reason, we would be closer to insanity than full normal functioning.
Wow.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Saints Unscripted. Sabrina and I are here today with Terrell Givens. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Welcome. We're really, really excited about this.
We're very excited. We're also petrified because we look up to you a lot. Wow. And have learned so much from you.
Thank you.
And are excited to learn more.
Teach me.
Yes. We want to talk today about, so there's a new series of books out at Deseret Book called Let's Talk About, and then there are different topics, polygamy, the Book of Abraham, all these different things.
Grace and priesthood.
Yes, and Terrell has written one on faith and intellect. This is an extremely important subject, and it's one that we go over from so many different angles on our channel because this is such a pressing topic for youth today and adults today. And so kind of what we've done, we've listened to your book on audio, your wife narrating, which is fantastic.
So soothing.
So soothing. And there were so many impactful quotes. Kind of what we wanted to do is just bring up some quotes from your book and talk about them and have you expound on them a little bit and share your thoughts. Is that okay?
Sure. Yeah.
Where should we begin? Did you want to start with one or should I? I'm happy to.
Yeah, you start.
Okay,
you
I'm
start.
Happy to.
I have plenty, but yeah, I don't know.
So this book is about kind of this perceived contention between faith and logic or intellect. And there are a lot of people who have a hard time reconciling the two. So one of the quotes from your book is, faith is not a silencing of the intellect. It is the only path by which the fullest appetites of the intellect find satisfaction. What do you mean by that? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think one of the distinctive features of the Restoration is we frequently find this language in Scripture about mind and heart. I will tell you in your mind and heart.
Yeah.
And so it seems that in the Latter-day Saint tradition, we have this kind of two resources, both scriptural and historical.
I want to see your hands. I'm moving to this. Continue.
Both scriptural and historical that give us good grounds to believe that the fully integrated life of discipleship has to find a way to incorporate both reason and faith. And you know, we find a conflict between the two in the minds of some people in the very, very first Christian centuries, right? The famous statement of Tertullian, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? What does classical philosophy have to contribute to gospel understanding? But almost immediately, there's a counter push by those who believe, well, God speaks to us through the heart as well as through the mind. And so the dominant tradition in the Christian past has been a respect for intellect, a respect for the powers of reason, and seen those as consistent with the claims of faith. And what I meant by that particular quotation that you cited was that if we limit our means of finding truth to strictly analytical or logical processes, then it seems to me that we are cutting ourselves off from a phenomenal array of realities, experiences, truths that we have to access through means other than purely reason. If you think about the most important decisions that you make in your life, I'm guessing that when you decide to get married, you're married,
yep.
Sabrina, you both are, I'm guessing that you you didn't actually write down a list of pros and cons and then subject it to a kind of cost-benefit analysis of the...
No,
we respond to intimations of the heart, to gut instinct, to moral intuition, to other kinds of faculties that we might not even have a name for. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the most interesting studies that's been done in neuroscience is cited by Antonio Damasio, who's one of the most prominent writers on the subject of neurology. And he cites numerous studies of people that have had damage to the prefrontal cortex and have lost the capacity to feel emotion, to respond affectively to the world. Mm. And he said, what also always accompanies that loss is an incapacity to make meaningful decisions. Oh. And so it turns out that we can't function in the world. I mean, it's empirically verified. We can't function effectively in a purely logical or analytical way. Mm. So that's a long answer to a short question.
That reminds me of just one of your other quotes here. And I think you were quoting somebody else. I don't remember who you were quoting, but the quote was, the madman is not the man who has lost his reason.
Yeah.
The madman mm-hmm. is the man who has lost everything except his reason.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a quote comes from G.K. Chesterton, who until C.S. Lewis was probably the most widely read apologist in Christian history. And, you know, what he's saying, he was a great one for the paradox and the well-turned phrase, but the kind of the philosophical precedent for what he's saying probably comes from David Hume, the empiricist philosopher, who said the passions are, reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions. Now that's a funny thing for a philosopher to say, let alone for an empiricist, right? Mm-hmm. But what he meant by that was something that has become confirmed in recent years by evolutionary biology, and that is that we have no real reason to believe, evolutionarily speaking, that the mind developed to give us access to truth. The mind developed, as all other faculties develop, as a way of ensuring survival and reproducibility and flourishing within the web of life. So we don't have any real basis for confidence that our rational faculty has evolved to give us access to some kind of ultimate truth. What we do know, and again, this is empirically verified in any number of studies in cognitive psychology, is that our minds actually are employed by us most often to provide rational arguments for things we already believe. So we have an intuitive response mm-hmm. to the world or to an action. Or, you know, you walk outside and you see somebody abusing a child, right? We don't go through a logical calculation to decide if that's right or wrong, bad or good. We intuitively know, mm-hmm. but then we'll formulate an argument to give expression to our rational foundation for a moral position. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Chesterton means when he says, if you strip our minds down to nothing but pure logic or pure reason, we would be closer to insanity than full normal functioning.
Wow. So at the end of chapter 2, there's a lot of discussion about different times and when we see intellect and faith growing, right? And there was a description that you gave at the end of that chapter about the Dark Ages. And you said at the end, if those were the Dark Ages, I pray God give me a little darkness.
Yeah.
And I just thought that, like, that I was driving when I got that one. I, like, had to pull over and write that part so I didn't forget it. But can you just expand upon why we, like, the Dark Ages, and maybe more about that quote, too, since I didn't get the first part.
Okay, so that was President John Taylor that said that. And if you just stop and consider for a moment the significance of what he is saying in the context of restoration thought about the history of Christianity, apostasy, restoration, suddenly you realize that almost everything we thought we believed about apostasy and restoration is being blown to smithereens by what he's just said.
Yeah.
So what he's saying is that even in that so-called period of Dark Ages, that there were people who communed with God, people who revealed beautiful pieces of light and truth. The single most influential person probably in my life and in the life of Fiona is a mystic who lived in the 1300s by the name of Julian of Norwich, who communed with God, who shut herself up into an anchorite cell for 20 years, pondering, praying, fasting, until she could explicate for a Christian world the nature of God's love that she had experienced. So President John Taylor is acknowledging in that statement that the apostasy, so-called, does not represent a total eclipse of light and truth. So another way of looking at this is when the scriptures tell us that we should seek out of the best books words of wisdom. Well, the best books is not referring to the scriptures, because scriptures are so designated when they're referred to in the canon. Joseph Smith, on numerous occasions, right, suggested that we need to accept truth from wherever it comes. We need to be much more voracious in our intellectual and spiritual appetites. And in recent years, some of the best scholars in the church have undergoing a pretty thoroughgoing reexamination of what apostasy and restoration might mean if we pay more careful attention to the manifold voices in the Christian past, and find that there have always been people who had access to light and truth. And I think one of the imperatives that falls to us is to do a better job of recognizing and celebrating and assimilating those voices and truths into our own tradition.
One of the things you talk about in the book is, and this was a revelation to me, that it was religious people early on who were the scientists, who were studying natural law.
Mm-hmm. We're starting the schools.
Yeah. And one of the things you said that impacted me, you wrote that impacted me, was that they were studying natural law because they believed that there was a legislator of that law. Can you talk to us a little bit about kind of the evolution? Because when we think about that, that's not how we think about things anymore. Like, the scientists are the rational ones, and it doesn't make sense to believe in a God. So this is kind of the atheist camp.
Right.
But that wasn't how it was before. And maybe that's not how it is now, but that's kind of the stereotype, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, we're still suffering the after effects of a fabricated war between science and religion that emerged in the late 19th century. It was in the aftermath of Darwin. And you had Andrew White at Cornell and a few other famous voices who published books entitled The War or the Conflict Between Science and Religion. And so they created this false dichotomy, which mm-hmm. is not a part of the Christian or the scientific past, because those are artificial demarcations that we've made today. They've been emphasized by people like Stephen Jay Gould, who talk about the different magisteria. Religion asks one set of questions, science asks mm-hmm. another kind of question, and there's no intersection or overlap, which is a gross overstatement, really, I think, of the situation. And I think one of the great things about the Restoration is the way in which it just emphatically resists that dichotomization. People in the Christian past had a deep reverence for reason and intellect as God-given gifts, and so they applied those gifts to the entire range of questions of great moment, whether we would call those religious or scientific. I think C.S. Lewis was one who first expressed the state of affairs in the way that you just referred to, that the mere fact that we are seeking to understand the laws of the universe presupposes there's a legislator who put those laws into place. And so there's also the fallacy that, as you just alluded to, that to be scientific, to be a successful cosmologist or physicist today presupposes an atheistic posture, and, mm-hmm. and that's just demonstrably false. I mean, the British magazine The Economist did a survey a decade or two ago in which they surveyed members of the scientific community, and I don't remember the exact statistics, but it came out that about half are believers in God and about half aren't mm-hmm. in terms of accomplished professional scientists. So that's a myth that needs puncturing. In fact, there are numerous stories of scientists who have been brought to a place of belief. Let me give my favorite example, not of somebody who did come to belief, but somebody who came right up to the abyss and then rejected the obvious implications. One of my favorite books in science is called Just Six Numbers by Martin Rees. Martin Rees is the Astronomer Royal of Great Britain. Okay. One of the most accomplished astrophysicists in the world. He's written this book called Just Six Numbers, in which out of a possible 100 different examples, he chooses just 6 instances of cosmological constants. These are scientific principles that describe certain aspects of the universe in terms of what make life possible, right? For example, the rate of expansion of the universe. If the universe were expanding too rapidly, then matter could never coalesce and you wouldn't have stellar formation and planetary life. If it were expanding too slowly, then you wouldn't have had the initial dispersion that makes possible, right? The same phenomenon, everything would have just stayed into one great mass. He says the rate of expansion is so finely tuned that if it were greater or less, by just a minuscule fraction, life would be impossible.
Yeah.
So that's one example. And then he goes through 5 others, right? The totality of mass and the universe and nuclear strong forces, all, right? 6 different constants. And he says, together, for all 6 of those constants to have been finely tuned to the degree that they are, he said, it's not just unlikely, it's statistically impossible, given the relatively short duration of the universe's life. The odds of that happening are just wildly implausible.
Which is saying a lot, considering the universe is still millions and millions years of age.
Yeah, 13.
But even given that, it's still...
Yeah, so he says we can only derive 1 of 2 conclusions from that, right? Either there's a God who finely tuned those constants, or there's an infinity of universes, right? There's a multiverse. And, right, more than one person has noticed, but that's a religious proposition, because by definition that's not testable, right? If we can't test for the existence of universes outside of our own universe.
Right.
And so that's an example to me of where a scientist comes up by his own mode of analysis with a conclusion that practically calls for belief in God. And yet, instead, he embraces the alternative.
Which still requires belief.
Which still requires belief.
Yeah.
A non-testable hypothesis. Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm curious about your thoughts specifically on the Latter-day Saint faith and theology. We're on social media. Comment sections are generally a cesspool. And we see all the time, as other young Latter-day Saints do, just the comments saying, you know, people just laughing at Latter-day Saint beliefs and thinking they're completely illogical, thinking that they're silly.
If only they knew more.
They judge me before they even know me.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, because I find it impossible to believe that anyone would look and listen to you and think that guy is irrational. You're obviously a very intelligent, educated person. What is your perspective on that accusation that it is illogical or silly to be a Latter-day Saint?
Well, that is hard to know how to respond to that, because I find one of the most appealing features of Latter-day Saint theology, its supreme rationality. I'll give you just a couple examples, right? Richard Dawkins was doing an NPR interview on the radio, and he's resorting to his usual shtick, which is to make fun of the God of Christendom as no more plausible than floating spaghetti monster. And at one point in the interview, he actually says, "Now, if you wanted to posit that God is just a super highly developed intelligence, well, that I could believe, or that would at least be plausible." Right? And I thought, somebody needs to give him the King Follett discourse. Because that's the Latter-day Saint God, right? So there are a number of philosophers and scientists. I think Stuart Kaufman would be a great example, somebody working at the Santa Fe Institute, an incredibly interesting place that's doing cutting-edge science. You've got Thomas Nagel, one of the preeminent philosophers of our current age, both of whom are not believers, and yet both of them say, you know, it's not that Darwin is wrong, it's that Darwinism is just inadequate. There is something else going on. Matter just seems to conform to some kinds of principles of self-organization that lead to ever greater forms of complexity in the universe. And suddenly we get consciousness and life and values and all of these things. So it seems to me that in really crucial ways, Latter-day Saint theology is perfectly conformable to, right, cutting-edge research in these kinds of areas, right, science of self-organization, of complexity theory, and evolutionary science itself, that say ever more complex forms just keep emerging, and it makes supreme sense to me that given enough time, we would come up with a figure like God who has mastered the laws of the universe, understands the principles by which it is organized and unfolds. So that's one example of the rational appeal of Latter-day Saint theism. And then let me just relate an anecdote that I think conveys to my mind not just the rational but also the moral appeal of Latter-day Saint theology. About 20 years ago, there was a woman who was hired by an anti-Mormon organization to go into the family history library and to see if she could put through the name of a Holocaust victim for temple work. And then she went to the press and said, Latter-day Saints are baptizing Holocaust victims. And she succeeded and got the attention of Elie Wiesel and other preeminent Jewish voices. And the New York Times covered it, and it was it looked like a disastrous episode for the Latter-day Saints. I received a phone call, was asked if I would go on to a Philadelphia radio station and talk about this practice. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the host was Jewish. And first question, live out of the gate, national audience, what are you doing baptizing my dead ancestors? And I said, as Latter-day Saints, we believe that we have a Heavenly Father who wants to gather the entirety of the human family to himself in a virtual wedding feast at the end of time, and we believe that it's our privilege to send out the guest list. And we don't think you have to come, but we think everybody should be invited. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do when we baptize for the dead. And he said, what an incredibly beautiful idea. How do I get my name on that list? Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, clearly he was half joking, but the response seemed to be a clear indication that there was a recognition here. What an incredibly generous, any God worthy of adoration would have to have in place a system that made possible the education, the healing, the restoration of the entire human family.
Yeah.
And that's what restoration theology offers. So we could just keep going through the whole list of what's plausible and what isn't plausible in terms of belief about a reality that transcends the immediate and the physical. And time after time after time, I find the responses just plausible, appealing, aesthetically satisfying, and morally justifiable.
Do you have thoughts, or do you think a lot about the historical origins of the church?
I don't.
And I suspected you didn't. But why? Because that's what a lot of people are basing their claims of silliness off of.
Right.
Sure. Here's the problem. I was at a Mormon history conference many years ago in which the keynote speaker was the president of the Community of Christ. Lovely man, good scholar, and one of his opening sentences was, history as theology is perilous. He was making a pitch for divesting ourselves of all this historical baggage so that we aren't locked into a corner when it comes to the contentiousness of certain historical claims that can be subject to scrutiny and, right, documentary analysis. And he said, theology should just be theology, it should just be belief. And I wanted to stand up and say, well, yeah, you're absolutely right. History as theology is perilous, and it's absolutely inescapable. Christianity is predicated, first and foremost, on a historical claim. If you want to say that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is just a nice parable or a myth or a story, then the whole framework of Christianity just dissolves and we're left with nothing except a nice story. In a similar, analogous way, restoration claims are predicated on the absolute historical veracity of certain episodes. But just as I don't care if Jesus was born in Nazareth or Bethlehem and in 4 BC or 2 BC, And I don't care if the accounts get that wrong. That doesn't touch on the question of whether Christ was the Son of God and resurrected on Easter morning. In a similar way, there was an event that transpired in the Sacred Grove when Joseph Smith had contact with the divine. And through any number of intermediaries, he received divine authority and power to establish sealing powers again. And what I call the true cosmic narrative about human souls and origins. Most all the rest is in that category of, well, is the dating right or wrong? And is the place right or wrong? And do we have conflicting narratives and stories about the details? I just think that we need to know what questions matter and what questions don't. Hmm. Are these powers real? Do the resources of the Latter-day Saint tradition give us access to God in a new and powerful way? Do they reveal important truths about the nature of reality, the nature of our relationship to the divine? In all of Fiona's and my experiences over the years speaking to numerous audiences, I think it's significant. We've never had somebody come to us and say, you know, I just can't buy the idea that there's a Heavenly Mother alongside a Heavenly Father. I just can't buy the idea that our soul is eternal. I just don't think God really wants to save the entire human family, right? Well, there's something wrong if all the criticisms originate from the historical sphere, yeah. And yet none of them seem to be touching. So that's what I meant with slight exaggeration when I said, no, I don't pay much attention to I'm not obsessed with the historical details of our narrative. Yeah.
It's kind of a missing the forest for the trees.
I think it is. I think it is. And I think we also have a tendency, ever since the dawn of social media, to steal other people's questions and think they're our own.
Yeah.
And so when I have a conversation with somebody who wants to have a serious conversation about religious things, I just want to make sure, are these really your questions? Mm-hmm. Because more than once I've asked somebody, so why does that matter? Mm-hmm. And they're caught up short, and they'll say, well, I'm not sure. I saw it on the internet. It looks like a really good question to be asked.
Yeah, I know that there's discussion in your book about how we're sticking with questions longer is important.
Yeah.
And this is making me think also you need to stick with important questions longer.
Yeah.
And because if you're bringing up these questions that maybe you've heard from other people or that really don't matter, you're just trying to stir something, then there's no point in hanging on to that question to get further intellect and faith.
Right, yeah, I love that quotation. I don't know that it can be documented, but it's attributed to Einstein, who said, it's not that I'm smarter than my colleagues, I just stick with the question longer. And Richard Bushman and others have spoken about this, that one way of framing the faith journey is, right, we have a kind of simple childhood faith, and then questions suddenly emerge on the horizon, and we do a quick internet search, and we're gone.
Yeah.
But it's been my experience that those who are genuine seekers, if they stick around long enough to really pursue the question in depth, more often than not, they find satisfying ways of addressing it.
Another question I have is, maybe it's more of a, I'm not necessarily going to pose it as a question, but I'm interested in hearing just your testimony of the restored gospel. Why are you in this church?
There is such an interesting variety of testimonies in our faith tradition, right? I mean, you've got the DNA Mormons and those who just are here for the community, and those are here because they had a sacred experience in their own sacred grove, and I don't know that I could designate as one category or one particular experience that explains my commitment to the restored gospel. I think initially discovering the gospel as a young man in my teens. My father was bookish. My father was an intellectual. He was a historian. And he was attracted to the church because he thought its theology was coherent and appealing. And so I think I followed in his wake. I was a voracious reader, read everything I could in church history. and doctrine. And from that day to this, I have found our theological tradition inexhaustibly rich. You know, I love the story of Sterling McMurn, who wrote his little book on the philosophical foundations of Mormonism. He himself was a non-believing Mormon. And he said somebody stopped him in the hall shortly after it came out and said, "Sterling, you make Mormonism seem so much more intellectually appealing than it is." And he said, "Well, that's because Mormons think it's so much less intellectually compelling than it is." And I think to some extent that is still true. So that's a partial answer, is that as I've explained, I just think that the doctrines are the most... To me, you know, there are lots of beautiful things that have been said throughout Christian history by any number of important figures, but the fact that the main body of Christians could still be laboring 2,000 years later over the question of whether infants are damned if they're unbaptized, to think there are still vast numbers of people who think that God predestines to salvation, to think that it's all about a verbal right confession. I just find Latter-day Saint doctrine compelling in a way that appeals to the heart and the mind. And I feel that I've had my own sacred experiences that confirm to me the reality of a divine presence that is of the same nature as the God that we find described in Moses chapter 7. I don't think a God who is unmoved by human suffering is worth my adoration. I think the God of Moses is, and that's the God that Joseph Smith restored.
Terrell, we are just super, super grateful that you took the time to come and share your mind with us, and also your spirit. And I know that at the end of your book, in the conclusion, there was a little bit of talk about the importance of becoming a deeper person. And so maybe just like in conclusion to this episode that we could go on forever about, could you just, I don't know, share any last words that you have, whether or not it's related to this, but just kind of how can we become deeper people ourselves too?
Yeah. Yeah. You're referring to a comment that was made by a professor of religion, mm-hmm. which was one of the harshest put downs, but also one that I think every professor has wanted to say at one time or another when yeah. the student said, "What can I do to make my paper better? Be a deeper person."
Yeah, it's like nothing right now.
I wish I had memorized, right, the statement that Joseph Smith made about, you know, "Thy mind, O man, right, must stretch as high as the deepest heavens and as deep as the deepest abyss." I love what Lucy Mack Smith said about Joseph. She said he didn't read widely, but he read deeply. And you know, we are renowned among sociologists of religion for what they call the sacralization of work, right? We don't just think of work as part of the curse of Adam or necessary, but that's kind of the end of our existence, is to be meaningfully engaged in productive labor of one kind or another. The beehive is the state emblem of Utah. All of that tradition emphasizes activity, right? In fact, we're unique among Christians in saying, we don't say he's a lapsed Mormon, we say he's a inactive Mormon, like the battery was turned off, right? We don't stop to think, what a weird expression that is. We're active or we're inactive. And so what that means is that we have this cultural inheritance and a theological emphasis that does not easily inculcate the spirit of contemplation and pondering, which are essential for the deepening of the soul. And I glory in the heritage of the Latter-day Saints that, you know, in the swamps of Nauvoo or in the arid deserts of Utah, right, the first thing that they turn their minds to is education. We'll create a school of the prophets or a Hebrew mm-hmm. school or that school, the University of Nauvoo. And so we have this heritage that says part of what it means to become like God is not just to love as God loves, but to learn as God learns and to understand as God understands. And so I just think it's a religious imperative that we have to study, to ponder, to reflect, and try to deepen those parts of our soul that are engaged with questions of ultimate meaning.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I know you work at the Maxwell Institute. Our audience is largely a younger audience that may not be as involved in the content of the Maxwell Institute, but you have their ear. Before we end, do you have any final thoughts for our audience that may be investigating the gospel, the restored gospel? Maybe they're former members, maybe they're faithful members, maybe they're struggling with their faith right now. Do you have any advice for any of these groups?
Yeah, I, you know, my concern always when somebody is in faith struggle, faith wrestle,
mm-hmm.
anything to avoid the cliche, right? Faith crisis. you know, my first question is always, well, are you still asking questions? You know, real questions, genuine questions. And if you are, there are two organizations I'm associated with that I think are right for that kind of a person. One is the Faith Matters organization, which is predicated on what they call an expansive view of the gospel. Absolutely committed, but also absolutely engaged in asking hard questions and wrestling with the questions. I think they produce terrific books and podcasts. And the other is the Maxwell Institute. And look, I had a great career at the University of Richmond. I had an endowed chair. I was in a perfect place professionally and personally. The only thing that could persuade me to leave was an invitation to join the Maxwell Institute, because I think that's the best church organization engaged in bringing together discipleship and scholarship and blending those two. That's its ideal, is to gather and nurture disciple scholars and to face the church as well as the public with the fruits of that synthesis. And so they also do just first-rate work. They have a series of books, the Living Faith series. They did the brief theological introductions to the Book of Mormon, as well as a great series of podcasts. So those would be my two recommendations.
And not to mention all of your own books and that you also co-authored with your wife. There are many of those.
The one that we've been talking about.
The one we've been talking mm-hmm. about. You're probably too humble to mention the other one, so don't mind us as we do, but you've got The God Who Weeps, the Crucible of Doubt. You wrote one on the Book of Mormon. There are several. There are many others, which I would highly recommend. Terrell, Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here.
We're so grateful. Here.
Everyone, thank you for watching, and have a great day.
Thanks for listening. If you want to watch our videos, check us out on YouTube or shoot us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.